I did have one guy actually. I don't know if we want to shout him out on air, but he called us a bunch of absolute hunks, and he wanted a shout out.
Oh,
who was that? Is it Scott?
No, I don't know if you guys, any of you guys know him. Although I don't know if you guys can see this. Can you see what his bio says?
Flat Earth. Oof. No shout out for you. Anti-science crew.
Yeah, he said.
This is like turned this, you know, me feeling pretty good about myself into like the exact opposite.
Yeah, the only guy who thinks we're hunks also thinks the Earth is flat. So, you know, connect the dots, boys.
He has an emoji.
Yeah.
The best part of it is the emoji next to it is the globe.
Mm-hmm.
It says flat Earth. And then it's a globe.
Well, you're only seeing one dimension of it, though, right?
That's a good point, actually. Maybe the Earth is flat.
Some people are just really dumb.
I mean, the emoji is flat, so.
It's true, man.
All that's going in. We recorded all that.
Hello and welcome to the Buy 1-8 podcast with Alex, Bryce, and Owen.
I'm Bryce Krawczyk.
And I'm Owen Hubbard.
This show is about powerlifters, but not just about powerlifting. Each week we discuss the experience of lifters as it relates to the sport and our lives as a whole. Sometimes these talks confirm our biases and sometimes they do not. This week we have a bit of a mailbag episode. We have reassembled all three of us to answer some of your questions. So thank you to everyone who has put in a question, etc. over the last few and hit us all up on Instagram. You can follow the show at x188 on Instagram. And yeah, we're going to get into these questions now. So Samuel, where do you want to start, man? What do you want to talk about?
I want to start where we were like 5 minutes ago before we started recording, when we were talking about when Bryce was skinny. When Bryce used to be in a metal band. And I think I remember, Bryce, you said at one point that like a particularly vicious tour with the band was kind of like a come to Jesus moment for you. And you were like, I should like get healthy. And that's kind of how you got started with all this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The reason I want to start there is because we got a question about how to gain weight. And I realized that we've just done two episodes on body image where we talked about like people kind of being a bit reckless with their cuts and kind of limiting themselves and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have yet to talk about how to properly put on size.
Right.
And I thought we could have a general kind of chat about that right now. So Bryce, why don't you start us off with what you did and what you do now?
So when I first started lifting, I just kind of, I had good people in my ears and they said, you know, if you want to get big, you should squat, you should bench press, you should deadlift, and you should overhead press. So I basically built a 4-day-a-week program around that. So I would bench and then do a bunch of hypertrophy work related to the muscles I worked in my bench. You know, same thing with a squat, same thing with a deadlift, be like a deadlift and back day kind of thing. So I think some of that additional hypertrophy work probably helped a little bit. I don't necessarily ascribe to that training philosophy as much anymore, especially if somebody comes to me specifically wanting to work on powerlifting. But if it's just a general person who wants to gain weight, you know, some of that other stuff provides a little bit more novelty, variety, which I think in a lot of cases can help with compliance. So, you know, there's probably some takeaways and some things to think about there. And then nutritionally, it was just learning to track my food. Like I use an app called MyFitnessPal and still use it to this day. I have all my body weight data from when I first started using it, just before my first powerlifting meet, where I think I cut to 83 because I was just barely over that at the time. But I was just learning to manipulate macronutrients. And I know that sounds simple and like, duh, count your food, forehead kind of thing. But I mean, that's really what it boils down to is understanding food in versus food out. Understanding how the impact that food has on your body composition and your body weight. And then learning to manipulate it to achieve the desired result. So, I mean, without getting too into detail, unfortunately, that's like the basic bare truth of it is I just learned to eat more than I burnt to gain weight. I did go through an interesting period, and I would like to mention this publicly because of Blaine Sumner, but I did chicken shakes before it was cool. I had a period of time where I just like got really burnt out from eating so much, and like couldn't sit down and finish a plate of food. It was just like really, really rough. So I worked with a nutritionist locally many, many years ago, and she was like, here, try these. So I had one shake. I had two shakes a day, and basically I'd alternate back and forth. I had like a breakfast shake and then a lunch shake and then an afternoon shake and then a dinner shake. And then I would eat like one solid meal, and that would put me well over like 4,500 calories. And the shakes were, there was a breakfast one, which was like a cup of berries, a bunch of Greek yogurt, some honey, a bunch of egg whites, some avocado, I believe. And then I would just like blend that up. And that one was actually really delicious. And the other one was like this hearty cold soup, which was basically either blended chicken or beef, rice or pasta noodles, a cup of vegetables, and chicken broth and avocado, and maybe like a little bit of olive oil. And I would alternate like drinking half of each shake in order, like I talked about there, until I had one of those cold soup broth things go rancid on me, and took like a big couple of glugs of it before I realized, and then never did it again.
So are we saying yes or no to chicken shakes as a legit way to gain weight?
Like, sure, why not? You know, I don't think it's an insane idea. You know, I'd probably put some vegetables and stuff in there, but I don't think it's that crazy. I don't think that it's like, maybe it's not sustainable long term for somebody who isn't trying to maintain a body weight of 180 kilos or more. But I don't think it's madness for like a period of time where you're feeling really stalled out and can't seem to gain weight. I would probably go with the berry one first and like try to eat your hearty sort of savory meals.
Oh, and have you ever smashed the chicken shakes?
No, not really. Like, I'm quite good at eating when I physically can't eat. Like, I used to like, not so much now because I'm probably higher up onto the 83 kilo, but when I used to be like 79, 80, my whole thing was like, get to where I physically can't swallow anymore, then take like 10 mouthfuls with water, like a pill form. So like, go to that point and then just become like a duck. I used to do that quite a lot. But I think what I like, people who I think who I like coach and stuff with, who are like, you would class as like hard gainers, I think the first protocol I always think is like, find foods that you like and then find easy ways to add calories to those foods. So the sort of stuff that Bryce mentioned, like olive oil into things, you know. I think a lot of people as well, when they first start gaining weight, they're like, got to eat protein. All right, what's that? Chicken breast. Yeah. It's like, chicken breast is the worst thing you can eat, man. Like,
chicken thighs.
I think a lot of people, yeah, exactly. Like, go from breast to thighs, eat the skin on everything. You know, find the fattier fish.
Increased oil content in thighs.
Like, there's just more calories in the meat, man. It's higher fat. So there's just more calories.
Okay. So like, I always think like, bang for your buck when you're first starting out trying to increase, how can you increase calories without increasing volume? Like, that should be your first protocol. And then once you've done that for a week, you might be gaining enough to just stay on that. It's like, I always think weight gain is the same as weight loss. If you're gaining an appropriate amount every week, why change it?
Yeah.
Like, if you're losing a little bit every week, you wouldn't go, all right, let's take another 300 calories out, because that's stupid. Mm-hmm. And it's the same the other way around. If it's working, just keep doing it. And then once it stops working, then try and, yeah. And like, the stuff that Bryce said is, I would class those as like sort of the more extreme measures, but for some people they're the appropriate measures, right?
Yeah.
Because you physically got no other, like you, the stuff you said there, like that was times when you were burnt out, your goals don't stop, you just got to find ways to meet them.
Yeah, those were definitely kind of last resort suggestions, but yeah. And I also, so some people swear that they can put like an ounce of olive oil in a shake and not taste it, no big deal. I remember doing like a shot of olive oil once, just like an ounce straight down the hatch. And I was like doubled up in the fetal position from stomach pain for like 30 or 40 minutes. It took like an hour or two, and I was actually at the gym, had just finished with a client, and was just like, oh, and just kind of like collapsed to the floor, and I was in terrible pain. I had to cancel an appointment, like went home sick for a while. And so yeah, I would say be a little careful with the olive oil, but maybe that's just my own experience. I don't know.
I think that's more a case of like drizzles on food, yeah, do you know what exactly. I mean? Rather than trying to just like smash it. So,
but one thing you can smash for fat macros is whipping cream, and that's something I lean on pretty heavily. So my coffee,
you do that a lot in coffees and stuff, right? Yeah,
coffee
shakes.
And like most of my protein shakes have whipping cream. An ounce of whipping cream is like 10 or 11 grams of fat, so it's a pretty easy way to supplement to get your fat macros in.
What are the other I guess stupid ways of gaining weight, for lack of a better term, like apart from the thing that Owen said that was pretty interesting, that you should try and keep volume the same for as long as possible in terms of your food intake, and up calories first. Are there any other kind of rookie mistakes?
Well, I remember back before I started powerlifting, but when I first kind of started strength training after I kind of stopped playing like sports more competitively, and I remember deciding that I was going to run the like Smolov squat program, and I was like, I got this good thing going, like everything was all cool. I kind of had like a relatively standardized like work structure and stuff, like kind of worked like every day 6 till 2, and it was I had like a pretty chill life. So I was like, I'm gonna like go for this training thing. So I decided that the only way for me to recover from Smolov was to have one of those like 1500 calorie takeaway pizzas every day and a bottle of Gold Top milk. So the Gold Top milk, I don't know if you've got it over in Canada, Bryce, but it's like a real high fat content, like basically like an unmessed around with milk. So it's like, there are like literally like lumps of like fat in it when you drink it. It's real tasty. It's basically like cream. But anyway, so I think I upped my like daily calorie intake by like just under 3000 calories a day. Cause one of these things was about 1300 and then the pizza was 1500. So I was like, every day that I train, which was 5 days a week at the time, I was like, I'm just going to add this to my training. I was like, my squat's obviously going to blow up cause I'm going to gain weight like crazy, which I did. So that was pretty awful. Yeah, that was pretty terrible. I mean, I gained weight, my squat went down. but I gained some weight.
Like
so,
apart from the obvious terrible experience of eating and drinking all that, what else about it was shit?
Oh, dude, you know? Just like, you know, like how when you're eating like a well balanced nutritional diet and you kind of like feel good and you like eat vegetables and fruits and stuff, like just imagine the opposite of that.
I don't
like
know that.
I just felt terrible. All the time, like digestion was awful. I you could just tell that I was just having like everything I ate was highly processed and was just kind of gross. So to be fair, like a lot of the rep numbers kind of went up by the time it got round to testing in Smolov. I was just like done. I also think that like programs like that, when like me at the time, my like squat pattern was not even remotely ingrained. So like every session was like different and I was just like shoving loads, like proverbial load down my own throat, like just doing, I was just surviving every single session, you know, like I'd stand at the top of my squat and just like drop. Like there was no intent, there was no accuracy in like where I was going, what I was doing, what I was trying to do. It was just like, okay, I got to do 7 of these and then I'd do that and I'd like collapse and I'd rest 10 minutes and I'd go for my next set. And form probably got worse and worse every week. So it's no real surprise that. But
I think
know.
Like digestion is a big thing though. Like what you said there, like I think a lot of people don't, especially when you're trying to like bulk and put on weight, like you forget that like your gut bacteria changes with what you're eating and you ignore those things, like especially with like dairy as a prime example. Like when you've, dairy is a very easy way to increase calories because it carries with it quite a bit of protein, so generally it's easier food to eat. A lot of dairy is liquid or at least viscous a little bit, so it's quite easy to get down. But like you slowly get digestive problems from that by eating too much, and then you don't like notice that and change your eating habits, it can affect your training, like exactly like you said. You know, like if you're training, if you've got massive gas, or like you need to go to the toilet every 4 minutes, is that going to be the best thing for your training? Like, doesn't mean the calories are too much, but are you eating your calories at the right time? Are you spitting it out well? Like, every time I try and increase calories, I know I got to stay away from like dairy around training. So I stick to things like fruit and bread, because I know that that's going to give me the carbs, but I'm not going to have that issue. And I think a lot of people with bulking, I feel actually a lot of people have this maybe more than dieting, where when you diet, you're like, hit your macros, you're really quite strict. But when you're bulking, people are like, let's go fucking mad. Like, just give me 3 gallons of milk, 2 tubs of butter, and just pour ice cream all over my chest, and just I'm ready for it.
Just lay down, like, in a bathtub and start swallowing.
Exactly. Just give me a straw and see you in 3 hours. I think people have that like diehard mentality where it doesn't really need to be like that.
No.
And like, Bryce, you're a perfect example of that, where you just chip away, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. One of the best sort of recent changes I made to my nutrition, probably about a year and a half ago, was I was feeling really like gross. You know what I mean? I don't think I had enough higher quality foods. And by that, I guess I would mean like more micronutrient dense foods in my diet. So I talked to my current nutrition coach about it, and since then adding, so not even like taking anything away or not eating ice cream or whatever, but always adding a serving of fruits and or vegetables and some kind of like healthier fat to every meal. So not only is that a better way for me to space my fat out throughout the day, rather than just drinking like 6 ounces of cream before bed, but you know, like some carrots and hummus with lunch or whatever, and little things like that, I think have helped a lot in terms of, I guess, feelings of general well-being while eating a lot of food every day.
I think there's probably one other thing I'd add to that, dude, and that is if people are kind of like isocaloric and they want it, so their body weight is stable and they're kind of tracking what they do, a super easy way to add something in is like an intra-workout carbohydrate. It's one thing that's like nothing really needs to change, and you just throw in like a 50 to 70 gram carb shake during your training, and all of a sudden it's easy, and it's super cheap to do as well.
Yeah.
So that's like a super easy way to add 200-300 calories, and somebody doesn't really even notice it, and you can tend to avoid a lot of these issues that you run into if you're really trying to push that bulk train hard. So I think that's probably a good place for someone to start if they were going to look to do that.
And you can go like so off of that, I buy like a tub of iced tea powder, fruit punch powder, or some sort of like sugared drink flavoring, and then I drink that while I train. So again, like you can just buy a tub of that for $4 or $5 here in Canada anyways. I don't know what the equivalent would be in the UK, but it's pretty cheap stuff. And then you put, you know, 5 or 6 tablespoons in a big jug of water and drink that. And, you know, there you go. You've increased your calories.
Like instead of water,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
So that'd be like a Lucozade powder or something,
yeah, exactly.
Similar, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We have Gatorade here, but I think it's like identical. Yeah.
Is Mark Bell's bicep board going to revolutionize arm training in the way that he has promised?
Yes.
Serious question is...
Yes.
Come on, man. Exactly.
Who said yes? Why?
Dude, I have no idea. I'm not exactly sure what it is. I just wanted to play devil's advocate today.
It's because when Peach was young, he used to like curl his skateboard.
Yeah.
Like,
didn't everybody? Right? Isn't that just the most natural movement pattern? That's what our caveman ancestors did, was
skateboard.
They curled their skateboards. Anyways.
Besides the skateboards, what are some kind of weird or unusual pieces of equipment, like maybe, I don't know, maybe you're using a machine in like a way kind of besides what it was intended for that you found like really effective? Like, Owen, we recently brought up your lawn chair plus axe of that.
I'm interested to hear more about this.
Yeah, he calls it the lazy strongman, don't you, Owen?
Yeah, it is. Axelbar, seated axelbar on dining room chair.
All right.
It's pretty key. It's like it's been nice, good back support.
Nice.
It's pretty good.
I've been doing some seated overhead press as well. I just turned my bench around and bench out of the rack seated because I'm not sure how high my ceilings are down in my basement. So I've been hesitant to just like toss a plate into the ceiling. So seated overhead has been the way to go. I've also been doing a lot of like pull-ups off of a combo rack, so different like sort of horizontal and vertical pulling patterns, either like just using my feet to assist me or doing like a, I think Bryce Lewis posted some of him putting his feet up on the bench and kind of doing like a half horizontal,
it's almost like an L-sit, right?
Yeah, like an L-sit kind of pull. So I've been incorporating some of
those. I didn't even know they were like that. I thought they were like quite a usual thing.
You see, I feel like when he posted all the time, don't you? Like competitions.
Everyone do, they're just a natural thing to do. Like, I feel like they've been around for ages, but yeah, I like doing those. Like, pull-ups on a combo rack are surprisingly good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always surprised on how effective they are. As a pull-up bar,
it's because of that sweet knurling, man. That beautiful Nico just grips your hands. Yeah,
and also Meadows rows and lever rows as ways to kind of like almost emulate a dumbbell if you only have a barbell.
This is one thing that got kind of like popular over here in the UK when somebody was like, "Oh, you know, I've only got access to a barbell." So it's like, okay, wrap a towel around the end of your bar, stick it in a corner, and then we suddenly have like a landmine, you know,
like
so
a T-bar kind of thing.
With yeah, the towel. Exactly, man. Yeah. So suddenly you've got like a T-bar row, a Meadows row, a lever row, landmine press. You can do like seated Z press with it. There's loads of rotational stuff you can do. So that's probably my biggest one that's kind of semi-relevant to recent times, I guess.
I just leave a plate on it and like let it pivot on the plate on the other side, because I was sticking it in the corner of my rack, but it was beating up both my bar and my rack, and I don't know how I feel about abusing the corners in the condo. So yeah, I just have it on like a grip, like on a horse stall mat, which is where I deadlift, and the grip of that is enough that the plate as it pivots won't really go anywhere.
Like, COVID's been so good for just people's ingenuity. It's crazy, suddenly everyone's freaking inventor. Right, we got a good question about new coaches. So all three of you guys have been coaching for a while. Do you have any tips for new coaches, what to expect and what not to tolerate with clients, both in terms of gen pop and powerlifting?
What not to tolerate?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the second half of the question. I think it's more generally about like, if you're a new coach, like, how do you not fuck it up?
This would be interesting from like Peach, me and you. We obviously still train some gen pop people, right? So it'll be interesting the difference in response here between me and you and Bryce, because Bryce, I'm making an assumption, but I'm assuming most of yours is powerlifting, right, Bryce?
Yeah, probably like 7/8 of my client load is powerlifting, competition specific.
Great use of fractions.
But I do have a like pretty small at this point, but a small contingent of people who just use the power lifts because they like that way of staying fit.
Where to start? I think my biggest thing, I feel like the best way to potentially frame this for myself is thinking about what I'd say to young me when I very first started training, like coaching people at kind of 18, 19, would be the clients that you struggle the most with, both in terms of communication and in terms of like whether or not that be results or just the general dynamic of the relationship, are definitely ones that you could learn the most from, and are definitely ones that you will like shine a torch to where you're weak. So like things that you don't know and things that you really struggle with. Like, there are a few clients that I coached way back when I was much younger that are still imprinted in my mind in terms of like why I struggled with them, what I needed to work on at the time, what I probably still need to work on now, and different things like that. Especially like when I very first kind of started coaching, would have been when I was 18. So what's that, like 9 years ago now? So 2011, like I hadn't really learned tons about diet, nutrition, different ways of approaching things. So like a kind of like a go-to for me at the time would have been like a paleo, massively like fruit, nuts, vegetables, you know, meat, fish, etc. And I remember working with a lady, and she was vegan, and I just had no idea what to do. I was like, but you need to eat this many grams of protein. And she was like, well, what do I eat? And I was like, and I just could not come up with like any answers at the time. And veganism back then wasn't like as well supported as it is now. So there weren't like loads of vegan supplements. Like the only vegan protein powder that there was just tasted like dirt. So that was really difficult. That was really, really difficult. And definitely like a lot of the, I think the biggest thing that I think if I could rewind time would be to learn a lot more about soft skills a lot sooner. So learning how to communicate, learning to understand like body language, nonverbal cues, all that stuff much, much sooner than I have now, because ever since I've started like pouring a lot more energy into that rather than like nerding out over like numbers and stuff like that, which was all I really cared about at the start, that's kind of where my coaching has improved and my outcomes and general ability to sing off the same hymn sheet as my client has improved massively. So I think that's probably the biggest advice I would give to someone. Like the sciencey stuff really matters, but like it doesn't matter in the way that you think it matters at the time of learning it when you first learn it. So yeah, I think that's probably my piece.
Yeah, I think like on the flip side of that, like what you're saying about communication and all that stuff is, I think, the best thing I've done to think from like and make my coaching better for the client is literally set out expectations at the start. I think when you very first start coaching, you're like pressured to be, oh yeah, I'm there all the time, I'm doing this for you, I'm doing that for you, like I sort of, oh yeah, you get 24-hour access, like 24/7 support. And it's like, that's for longevity in coaching, I feel like that's impossible. I feel like you need to have like, you know, this is your check-in, you know, even if it's down to, you know, we have check-in on a weekend or a Friday or whatever in the week, I'll try and get back to you. But if I don't get back to you, it's probably just because I'm busy X, Y, Z. And I think it's good to say like at the start, if that's not enough for you, that's okay. You know, I can point you towards someone else who might be a little bit more attentive, or they might have a slightly different approach. Like, I think it's important that both you and the client, whether it's powerlifting or whether it's gen pop, like you're on the same page on A, how to communicate, but also B, like what to expect from the programming or from the sessions. I think like that's the best thing, I think, coming out of it, because if you start with that and you exceed that, then they're just going to get a better experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I would echo both of your sentiments. I know, Peej, I've definitely had some clients before that I saw as like a big challenge, and I think in one or two cases was like on the verge of saying, I don't think we can do this, I think this is not going to work, and had some conversations with some other coaches and kind of changed my mindset towards it as an opportunity to work on my soft skills, and to try to like just break down whatever sort of barriers there were in the communication, and that ended up being a pretty rewarding experience. And yeah, definitely, Owen, I think in terms of like laying out expectations is so, so important, because a lot of the times people come into these coaching relationships and they're not sure, you know, how much of you they get. I think there's definitely an image created of an online coach on social media that is like, oh, if you're not if you don't respond within 2 hours and you're not, you know, constantly monitoring your client's Instagram feeds and just, you know, like doing a lot of these things that I think are in some ways unrealistic and unreasonable, then, you know, that's not the top tier coach. But I think the big thing for me and what I would recommend for somebody trying to get into it is maybe, you know, don't set your sights on working with just powerlifters right away. Get some experience with some gen pop, get some experience with people who want different things and want to do different things and try different things and have different goals, so that you can not only suss out what you enjoy doing, like maybe you'll find you enjoy working with weight loss clients who use powerlifting, or you enjoy working with intermediate lifters more than advanced lifters, you know, and I think figuring some of that stuff out and sort of where you fit within the industry is a big thing, because then you can appeal to that, and you can, you know, do the work that you're best at and work with the people that you enjoy the most. But I definitely credit a lot of my success in understanding movement and understanding technique, for lack of a better term, to taking people who could not do anything that even resembled a squat and getting them to the point where they can do a powerlifting style squat. If you, you know, you take 10 people through that process, and that's a year and a half in some people's cases. By the time you get to a person who can kind of squat, it's a lot easier to pick out those little things because you've gone through and just fine tuned and worked on this, you know, sort of very malleable and individual kind of thing, for so long, as well as just learning to understand how to track metrics and data and interpret it, I think has been something that I've incorporated a lot more of in the last like 3+ years. That's been super, super useful in terms of actually learning to individualize training and suss out like what actually is working and driving progress or not.
On the communication thing, right? Let's imagine you're a new coach, and I know this is going to be an individual thing and everyone's going to have a different threshold, but how, as a kind of general rule, how much of you should the lifter get? You know, like how much of your constant attention, like how regular should the check-ins be? I'm asking because I can think of a couple of times that I've seen, you know, friends of mine, other lifters, they're in the middle of a session and, you know, no matter how it's going, they are like in direct communication with their coach during the session, sending them this like one set before they do the next set and getting feedback on that. And like, regardless of how it was going for them, I always wondered like, how good is that for either of you, you know, for the athlete and the coach? Maybe some people absolutely love that and coaches are fine with that, but like there's got to be a bit, like you must eventually get to a point of paralysis by analysis, you know what I mean?
I think with that sort of setup, you have to be incredibly careful as a coach, because if you're allowing that or encouraging it, the athlete never develops any level of autonomy. Do you know what I mean? So if they send you one set, and then within that 5-minute window between their sets, you're cueing them or you're telling them what they did right, or what they didn't do right, or whatever, like that's actually not probably long-term going to be that beneficial. Like, so the way that I kind of balance this is I kind of say to a lot of the guys that I work with that I will probably reply to your messages between 24 and 48 hours after you sent them to me, excluding like weekend times kind of thing. So if they send it on like a Saturday evening, I'm not going to get back to them until Monday morning. And then giving them a platform for us to have a longer discussion. So whether or not that's like once a month where we have like a half an hour sit down, it's like, hey, we're going to do a block review, but anything you want to talk about, we can talk about now. That's kind of how I manage that, because as long as they know that they can sit down and they can like spitball and ask me loads of questions in like a free open environment, you know, where it's just me and them, then I think that that works. And then in terms of how much of you that they get, I think that kind of depends on how you decide and how open you decide to be through like social media channels and all those other things, right? So like in the case of some people, you might know who their partner is or what they do with their social life, and in other cases you might not. And I think that's just down to the individual person and how much they want to share. And also like any relationship, right? I think it's going to depend on like how that relationship is and how it isn't. Like there are some people that you might work with in person and you've known them for years and years. There's one guy that I've been coaching for pretty much since I started working in the fitness industry. And like, you know, if I was like, I mean, I'm not 30 yet, but like for my 30th birthday, I will imagine he'll get an invite. But I'm not going to invite every single one of my clients to that, right? Like he had a big birthday not too long ago and I got an invite to that. Like, and I, you know, I would want to go to that. Whereas that's not everyone. And I think that's fine. Like me and him have got a very different relationship to, you know, somebody that I might've started working with last month, right? So relationships are going to develop over time. And I think it's up to you kind of as a coach, you're kind of like your own brand. And I think you have to be very careful with what you want to share and making sure that what you do share is kind of on brand with everything else, right? Like, I think that's just a normal thing, I guess. But I know that not everyone's like that. And I know that some people like to share lots about their personal life and that's kind of included in their own social media platforms or their brand's platforms or whatever. I don't think there's anything wrong with it as long as it's consistent and people kind of know what is okay and what you're willing to share and what they're willing to share and not willing to share, right?
So as long as they go through the step that Owen mentioned where you just outline your expectations, like this is what you're going to get and this is what you're not going to get.
That's the most important part. Like that's the thing that always sticks in my mind is like under promise over deliver. Like that's always my sort of thought of like, if I know that I'm not going to always get back to you within the next few hours, I'm not going to say I'm going to get back to you in the next few hours. You know, I'm not going to say that. Like generally I'll set out, like I always try and say, like my communication's a little bit like, it's like two funnels back to back where like when you first start training with me, I'm probably going to talk to you a lot because you probably need a lot of feedback. Then after a while, you probably won't need as much because you're like Pete said, like a bit more autonomous. But coming towards competition, like those people who are 3, 2, 1 weeks out, they are further up on the priority list to me than the someone who might be on week one of an intro block and they're 20 weeks out from their next competition. Like you've also got to prioritize where people are in their development and in their training. And I think like not so much from a coaching perspective, but from like nutrition clients, I always say to them, like, hopefully in 6 months' time, you won't need me because I am going to give you that ability. And I suppose it is the same with training. It's like, if you have that confidence to play around with your own training and you don't feel like you need coaching, but you feel like you just need a little bit of guidance, that might just be where you get to that point. Like, I feel like coaching is one of those things where it's a journey, and where a person sits in that journey is both down to you, but also down to the way they progress. And I think like Peach said, like, if someone's messaging 24/7, like, what's this set? I'm not going to do another set until this set. Some people coach like that and that's okay, but I wouldn't expect that from a client because I haven't set that out as part of the parameters, you know. But it's all like I think I'm reiterating what Peach said really, but it's like it's very different between the person. And I don't know what you think, Bryce, because like for me, I still do quite a lot of one-to-ones, so I might be coaching one-to-one 6 hours a day. So I don't have that time to communicate with other people. So it'll be interesting what you do is like quite a lot of more online stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, I'm at the point now where I have like one or two in-person clients. And that's just, you know, like in some cases, like once a month, in some cases, once a week. And for some stretches of time, I won't do any in-person stuff. So for me, I have sort of a check-in structure. I have two sort of blocks each week where, you know, half my clients will send me check-ins on this day and I will do them this day. And then half my clients will send me check-ins on this day and I'll do them this day, like one over the weekend and one midweek kind of thing. So I've split my clients to that. And yeah, in most cases, they'll send me basically a week's worth of footage and a voiceover, and then I will respond to it much like you would see me on like a Form Check Friday or something, kind of draw on the screen a little bit and do that kind of stuff. So we have that. And then generally speaking, any messages outside of that, I'll get back to in about, you know, 24 to 48 hours. Obviously, like you said, Owen, you kind of, you know, if somebody shoots me a message and I see it come in and they're competing in 2 days, like, I'm going to open that up right away, because, you know, obviously there is a sort of sliding scale of priority with that kind of thing. If somebody else is like, hey, can I add bicep curls on day two, and they're, you know, 40 weeks out, it's like, yeah, I'll get back to that when I can, kind of thing. And then Peej also touched on something I think is really important, which is that sort of open forum, like almost a town hall meeting with the client. You know, I do those after most big blocks of training, specifically after meets, and we'll just schedule a time to chat for like an hour, sometime during the deload. And I take a lot of client feedback on the block construction. So if people have some sort of athlete intuition on what worked and what didn't, I think that's a really important thing to take into consideration. And yeah, I mean, like, the autonomy thing is another really, really important aspect of it, and trying to get people to the point where not only are they autonomous, but they feel like they're capable and competent. And I have a bit of a gripe with certain aspects of the coaching industry, where I think there are coaches out there who will pick apart technique and pick apart sets so that they feel like they have something to contribute. And maybe this isn't like a malicious thing or like a fault of their own necessarily, but they feel like the value as a coach is to be able to say like, oh, your left knee tracked like 3 degrees in on that third rep. You know, we should think about that. And I think I find myself more and more often in my check-ins being like, yep, it looked great. You know, you did a good job. Keep doing what you're doing. You're getting stronger. Like, it's working. You know what I mean? So a lot of times my check-in is more sort of conceptual and talking about the overall strategy, or, you know, some component that we can expand on that they ask the question about, and a lot less of technique coaching. And I think making that transition and understanding that transition is normal, and that's not the coach caring less, that's not the coach not having, you know, input or whatever, it's more that like, okay, you're doing a good job now, like, you're a capable, competent lifter. Your technique looks the same week to week, and I don't need to sit here and harp on it as if there's something wrong with it when it's perfectly sufficient. So yeah, I think there's something to be said for that.
I think the big thing there is like, technical development takes time, right? So this is the one thing that's like, on the back of what Bryce has said, is like, if you throw out a bunch of cues to a lifter and they're trying to learn something, like, they can't, well, it's very rare that you'll deal with someone, say you give them 4 cues, they're not going to be able to like process all 4 within the working model of a squat that's actually going to make any significant changes to them. So like, as a coach, you might implement cue number 1 on block 1, and you might let that sit there for 6 to 8 weeks, and then that's like in, and then you go for the next thing, and then you go for the next thing, and then you go for the next thing, and you can like layer in these changes. So like, sometimes if they're doing the thing that you want them to do and you've got notes on what you're going to introduce next, then that is more than sufficient. I think somebody made a really good post a little while ago on social media about coaches trying to justify their employment by like over queuing.
This is like, I was going to say, this came up on our episode with Avi a minute ago. Owen, you and Avi were talking about this. Like, I think it was specifically to do with competition day, that a lot of the bad, usually overcoaching that you see going on competition day is coaches effectively trying to give themselves something to do and justify their own existence.
Yeah, you know? I think you see it as well, like, where a coach hasn't been able, like, either they don't understand maybe what they're trying to achieve as much, so they overtalk, or the athlete is unsure or hasn't really connected with anything that they've said, so the coach hasn't necessarily got it down to a word or two, you know? Like, I think there is a case sometimes for cueing somebody when they're in and around the platform, but that might literally just be they get super nervous at heavy attempts, so you have to encourage them to maybe make sure that they take a full brace and don't just like stand there and then as soon as the rest of their squat they go okay cool and they just go for it, you know, like, so that might be a case of they can hear your voice and you say big breath or something, and then they connect with that and they do that thing that they wouldn't have done had you not said that, or maybe they just pay more attention to it. But I think if you're cueing, like, you know, they get under the bar and you're saying like, head up, you know, tight back, take a breath, take your time, small steps. And you're giving them like 17 things before they've even like,
that's just for the walkout too.
You know? Yeah, exactly, man. Like you should hopefully by the time that, well, actually, regardless of whether or not they're a beginner or advanced, is if you're going to say something, it should be down to 2, 3, 4 words, maybe, you know, like, if they have any problems, and if they don't, then just let them execute, you know, like they should be at that point where they're able to execute and you're not going to refine their technique on competition day.
Yeah.
So don't even try, like they've done the work, you know.
I think my favorite cue for competition day is, remember, you're going to have to push hard. Like don't forget to push.
I like that. I remember at the Commonwealth a couple of years ago, there was this Australian guy, and some guy came on and he just stood up in the crowd, and it was deadlifts. He came out and this guy stood up in the crowd, he was like really quiet, and he just stood up and he was like, fucking pick it up, mate.
Exactly. Like, exactly,
that's such a good cue.
He's got to stand up real hard, you know. I think sometimes, again, like we get over inundated with these cues and these, like, we spend too much time thinking about like movement quality and what good technique should look like and feel like, even, you know, you have those reps where you're a classic example last week, my equipped squat, I like just about went home afterwards because I was like, that was the worst equipped squat I've done in a long time. And I just looked at the footage last night and was like, oh, that was like not that bad at all. If anything was wrong with that, there might not have been. So yeah, I think sometimes we expect a lot out of this sort of feeling of feedback of competence. And I think if you can help a lifter feel that more often, like, yeah, no, you're doing a great job. And they're like, oh, I thought that set was shit. And you're like, no, it was good. Like, you're doing awesome. You're a really good lifter. A lot of the times that's the kind of feedback that's going to help them go back into that session, you know, the next one and lift maybe similarly, but feel better about it from a psychological perspective. And I think, you know, with how important buy-in is and confidence, I think that if you can help those things instead of picking the person apart all the time and being like, nope, that was shit. That was shit. Your left toe was pointed out more than your right. That was shit. You suck. No. You know, and like, I don't know, maybe that athlete exists that you need to do that with, but I don't know. I haven't found them.
Coach is listening to this. You are valid. You exist. I will not forget that you exist if you're just quiet for a bit. Guys, who are the most underrated lifters in your opinion? You get to pick one each. We have a few different, we got a few different versions of this same question. I always think it's kind of a good one because it's an opportunity to, you know, bring a little hype to someone that you think maybe needs more hype than they're getting.
I want to go first, and he's fresh in my mind. He's quite a big boy, and that is, I don't think enough people know about Dave Richardson from the UK, under 120. He's super sweet as well, and we talk relatively often, so that's probably why he's getting a bit of a shout out now too. But big deadlifter, conventional, beltless, it's just pretty alpha man, and I think not enough people really know about him. I'm sure there's somebody similar in Canada, but yeah, I think
that's a guy who picks it up.
He just, you know, he just picks it up.
He picks it up,
rags it. Yeah.
So yeah, I think that would be my one.
Great pick.
Oh, and you must know someone.
I'll
man.
Go next.
All right.
Yeah, let Bryce go. I'm thinking.
So I have a big fascination with a lot of the Ukrainian equipped lifters. And I think in the equipped lifting circles, they're, you know, pretty well known and not by any means underestimated, but I can, for whatever reason, this one performance of Sergey Bilyi comes to mind, where he was, I think, 96 or 97 kilos and just out totaled a whole bunch of 105s. And won his category in the World Games, broke the 105 equipped world record total, and just like put together this incredible 9-for-9 day. And I've gone back to that performance from the World Games, and I think it was, I want to say it was Poland, which would have been 2017. Anyways, I might be misspeaking there, but
that's the most recent one. Yeah,
I think it was that one. But anyways, yeah, he went in like barely over the weight class and it, to be able to compete with these guys and just like crush the next weight class up. And it was, yeah, 9-for-9, just like perfect execution, perfect load selection. And I just, I love to see it. The kind of stuff gets me super amped up. So yeah,
I would probably say I'm torn between people, but my hero in powerlifting is Sam Watts. And I don't know if most, I don't know, is do you think he's a bit underrepresented or have I gone a bit too hard? Because I feel like Sam is like the epitome of powerlifting.
British champion, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's a 105 British champ.
And like a bodybuilder as well.
He first competed in powerlifting 23 years ago.
Yeah.
And he lifted for GB in single ply 23 years ago. Then went into bodybuilding for a bit and then comes back, just gone, I'll give this a crack. Raw's around now. I don't need to put a suit on. Let's give it a go. And then goes from squatting like 280 to 325 in 9 months, but he's also nearly 50.
story like, time. So the first competition that I shot for White Lights Media, I believe was Sam Watts' like return to powerlifting. It was some random divisional West Midlands meet with like just divisional lifting, you know, like no one's like going crazy, everyone's just having a good time, like fun stuff. And then this fucking guy shows up and he's jacked out of his mind, like screaming, like so much hype. He like opened, like, you know, the next biggest opening squat was like just over 200 kilos. He opens up with like 260. He almost squatted 300 that day. Like, and like you said, he's a masters lifter. And then after he did all of his big lifts, he comes to the front of the fucking platform and does a little posing routine. And we were like, who the hell is this? And unsurprisingly, he's now become a huge force in British powerlifting. And I don't, and you know, European powerlifting. And yeah. I don't think, Owen, that you're wrong to say he's a little bit underrated. Because like, I remember I talked to you about this at Europeans, you know, friend of the show, Bryce Lewis, right? Love that guy's YouTube channel. And I got really excited for like this huge squat that he worked up to, which is in the 320s, I think, at USA Raw Nationals. And then like a few weeks later, in the same weight class, Sam Watt just squatted like the same, except he's like 20 years older than Bryce Lewis. And I was like, where is the hype for this? You know, like it's, yeah.
There's a video here of him squatting 332 in February.
There's actually one other person who is on the complete opposite end of that spectrum. A really, really young guy over here in the UK again, who is just absolutely completely obscene. And I think I've known him to be lifting since he was maybe 12 or 13, and that's Ray Bowring.
This is the wild thing.
Big Ray.
Ray
is just insane at the moment.
I feel like Ray should be 25. I'm just
he
like
tripled, I think like literally this week just gone, he tripled 330 in the gym raw.
Yeah.
And he's 17 or 18 years old now?
17, yeah.
And I remember him like at one of his first comps, I think he's Ray, I'm sorry if you're listening and I get this wrong, but it wasn't a lot. Like, there wasn't much more than a plate on the bar. And yeah, to see him, obviously his dad's got a massive legacy as well, Dean. But yeah, Ray is just crazy. And I think he broke the sub-junior world record equipped squat as well.
Yeah.
Last year, maybe. And obviously he's just destined for, well, touch wood, I hope that he keeps lifting, and I hope he keeps doing his thing, because he is an awesome dude, is, you know, the first person to offer to help out on a platform to do anything. Him and both Jack Johnson actually are both just great dudes and really, really help the sport of powerlifting a lot. So shout outs to both of those two. But Ray, yeah, I mean, insanely good squatter and just an insanely strong young man, really.
So in 2016, Ray went 140, 75, 145. His most recent meet results were 380, 200, 290. Mind you, that's from Classic in his first meet to Equipped in his next meet. But his first equipped meet, he went 190, 107, 162.
So yeah, quite a glow up, should we say? Mm-hmm. So yeah, he's definitely somebody to keep an eye on. I don't really think many people really know about him because, you know, he hasn't got a huge social media following. And I think, you know, people that know, like in the equipped world, or people that are kind of like well into this powerlifting thing, but
yeah,
he's well worth a follow and keep an eye on for sure.
Related question, who is the best powerlifter, pound for pound, who has never been IPF world champion in the open? You can't say Owen. It's cheating.
It's got to be Owen, surely.
Because I mean, no joke. I think it probably is Owen. But let's cast a wider net than just the people on this call.
Blaine Sumner comes to mind when he was competing Raw. I don't think, did he ever win a Worlds?
It doesn't just have to be Raw, by the way, Bryce. If you want to throw some more Ukraine?
Yeah, I don't know if Blaine Sumner ever won a Raw Worlds when Ray was competing. So that would probably be my first guess. Although there are a lot of really, really good like 93s and 105s in the US that like have just missed out, but would have, you know, been up there for potentially winning Worlds if they'd have gone.
Yeah, I mean, Ashton Ruska like comes to mind, yeah, for sure. I don't think he's got a world championship yet. And like, I don't know if you guys follow him, but his training is just absolutely ballistic. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he totals over 1,000 kilos at 105 raw. Like, it's just, it is dumb how strong that guy is.
I will say as well, like, any 59 kilo man, I think, like, that Leo Franklin, who's the Ecuadorian, I feel so sorry for him because he is freakishly strong, but he's always up against Sergey Fedorenko. So like, it's like, he's, I think his best total I'm looking now is like 6'10", at 59 kilos, which is obviously huge, but you're always up against Sergey. So I feel like that's not, I think it's a bit, you know, it's a bit of a bummer, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like you can't get away from him.
There's one other person I wanted to mention. I just have to find his name. I shared some training of his yesterday. Oliver Dahlqvist. He's a Swedish lifter, and I think has done some stuff raw, but has lately, like, he squatted, I think he's 93, he squatted 400 in training recently. And I was watching him bench like 330, 335 to a two board in his shirt the other day. He's got a good pull on him too. And honestly, like, I could see him really, really making a splash in the equipped scene once we're able to compete again.
I think he's the sort of guy where like he's been bubbling under the surface for a while. And I think eventually he'll sort of
he's got 20 or 30 meets under his belt here. He is open now, but just barely. First comp was in 2013, and yeah, his last total was like 942. So he's put like 35 kilos on his squat. His bench will be way bigger. I don't know what his pull's like, but yeah, I could see him having a way bigger year once we're back out to competing than he's ever had, you know, on the record before. So it'd be pretty cool to see what happens there.
I think some of the 72s as well, and the women's, like, has Isabella ever won?
I was going to say Isabella for this.
Yeah,
like,
that's a good one.
The real contenders for this prize are people who are, like, amazing, but they happen to kind of go up against, like, just straight freaks, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Isabella, like, amazing lifter, world records, been at it for ages now, contributed so much to the sport. And it's weird actually that she's just never gone ahead and won, you know. And it's because of the freaks in her weight class, because it's so stacked.
Yeah,
I mean, I had to pop out here for a second, but did Daniela Mello come up?
Nope, not yet.
So like she, I'm on Open Powerlifting and I've just got the all IPF lifters ever up, and she's ranked number 5th, literally right behind Amanda Lawrence, out of everyone ever, and she's 20 years old.
And their best total on the platform is the same. They've both totaled 6.13.
Yeah, so that is absolutely insane at 20 years old.
Yeah.
To be there, that is just
I didn't realize that she was 20. I thought she was.
I didn't realize either. I thought her and Amanda were the same age, but yeah. Amanda's a couple years older.
Crazy.
That's madness. Yeah. Cool. And the last permutation of this question that we got was just like, who are lifters that you happen to think like they might not be the strongest, but they're just so aesthetic, you know, that you just like can't stop watching them lift.
We spoke about this. Me and you, Samuel, spoke about that dude from Taipei.
Yeah,
something.
I love watching him lift. Yeah,
yeah,
dude, he is insane. Mm-hmm. Like poetry in motion, man. He's something.
He also, when he refs, he sits there with his back
so upright
on the chair, with just bulletproof posture, like throughout the whole session. And that's like, man, when the lifting's slow, I'll just watch him ref.
Yeah, I think there are a few of those folks for me. I think the one thing I really really like, technically, I love how Belkin lifts. I just think he's just so precise. So that's probably an obvious one for a lot of people. And who's the 93-kilo American guy with the massive bench? Oh, I always forget his name.
Jonathan Keiko.
Yeah, I love watching him bench.
Yeah,
he's a good all-round lifter.
He's way up here in the overall rankings too, like number 10. He totaled 868 at 93.
I think watching from a British perspective as well, watching Ellie Steele equipped squat, like her equipped squat, if you watch her warming up to the platform, it's the best thing ever, because she is like, she never gets flustered about anything. Like, she will quarter squat her last warm up with 2 minutes to go before she has to go out for her opener. Like, go, oh, fuck it, I'll keep my wraps on, walk over, go onto the platform, squat it to perfection. Like, at Arnold's, this is a couple of years ago now, she came off from a squat and her legs ballooned up, and it was because it's an exhibition, it's a 20-minute changeover. So it took him 17 minutes to get her squat suit off. And then she had 3 minutes to put her bench shirt on. She went 60, 100, opened on 140, I think. And 60 and 100 were like, they didn't even move. And he was like, Aaron was like, right, go on, you got to go on the platform. And she was just, oh, sure, no problem. Like, she is so cool under pressure. And that's the part of equipped lifting that I find really impressive. Like, not getting flustered when you're in your wraps and someone drops a bar off their back and you've got to stand there for a couple of minutes. And, you know, those sorts of things is what makes a good equipped lifter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so we interviewed her on the Equipped Bruce Tired podcast, and she was talking about how often and how frequently she competes. And I think that probably has a lot to do with it. Like, competing for her is just so absolutely normalized. It's probably very, you know, very, very similar to just another training day by the time she gets on the platform, because she does it very often, which I think is an interesting strategy.
Bryce, you mentioned Jamal
Browner.
Yeah, man.
He's not an IPF guy, at least not anymore. I think he was, and there's maybe some history there, but man, I could go through his Instagram feed and just watch him lift all day. Like, he's the epitome of that client you have that consistently adds weight but kind of undershoots just a little bit. You know, you program an 8 and they hit a 7.5, you program a 9, they hit an 8.5, and it just goes on and on and on, and produces like this. And maybe I'm just like like looking at this through rose-tinted glasses, because often I think those are very productive training blocks. But anyways, it just seems like he's always just like moving super well. His bar speed is like really consistent. His technique is really consistent. Yeah, there's just something about the way that he trains and the way that his training looks that just is enthralling to me.
Oh, I have another one. I have another one for someone who no one really knows about. Is in the UK, Harvey Robinson. Harvey has the most beautiful technique for someone who trains on a farm. Like, like self lift out, in suit by himself, in wraps by himself, just playing around, and everything Farmer is just Robinson. so squeaky clean. Farmer Robinson, yeah. He's the boy.
He's a really good example as well of a lifter who's very gradually gained weight and never held himself back with his training and his body weight. He's
loves his milk, that boy.
Yeah, he's a dairy farmer drinking that raw milk.
What is your worst powerlifting habit / the worst powerlifting habit that you see in people around you, without naming names?
I love training on bumper plates. I just love it. I just love how they feel. Oh, they just look so good. I know I shouldn't, but I can't help myself.
That's fair.
Not like the real big ones, like the weightlifting ones.
Yeah.
You know, so like they're not like crazy chunky, they're not like CrossFit style, but they're enough to be like, yeah, I'm loading this bar to the end, you know? That makes me feel good about myself, even though it's the same amount of weight.
When I'm having a bad day, I'll deadlift on the Texas Power Bar. Honestly, that is, in my opinion, the perfect bar to deadlift on. I find it's the like deadlift bar so is whippy. Too it's much. It just like is weird at lockout, and the stiff bar is just so punishing. Man, I love pulling on a Texas Power Bar. My worst habit though is probably not tracking my fatigue daily for Mike, and I'm really bad for that.
Wow, yeah, that is shit.
I would probably say exactly the same as that, but mainly because, like, in my mindset, if I don't wake up and unless I have crippling DOMS that I can't do a full bodyweight squat with, I'm like, I feel great. Like, right. I'm probably not, I'm like, I'm not fucked at all. I'm like, I'm not dying. Like, there's no, especially upper body, like, I could bench 8 days a week and I would put, like, my fatigue is a zero. I definitely could. I have not
8 days a week.
I probably I'd like could. To see this. Yeah, about like eight I'd times like a week, obviously.
Oh, okay. So there's the distinction I was looking for.
What I do, I get the calendar changed. But like that, and I'm the opposite of you guys, where sometimes I'm a bit of a like bar diva. So if I haven't got a good bar, like I fucking hate the Texas bar. It's way too whippy. It hurts my hands. Like, even a Texas bar, I'm like, no, can't lift today. Can't do my bench. I got a Texas bar, not an Aliko.
In fact, me and Owen got into like a little squabble on Instagram talking about the difference between the whip profiles between an Aliko and a Rogue. I think the Rogue is like stiffer.
Rogue is basically a deadlift bar. Like,
yeah, you've got no to be way, kidding. Man. Like the Ohio Power Bar?
Yeah.
It's so stiff. It's stiffer than the Aliko, man.
It's his face.
I think.
I don't know, man. I don't notice a single difference between those two bars.
Man. You're clearly not deadlifting enough, man. You're not deadlifting enough.
What bars are good enough for you?
Anything that's IPF proofed. Like, I'll take a tight X if I have to. But like anything under that, I'm like, I'll bench on a Texas.
But the Ohio's approved.
Yeah, it's fine. I love an Ohio bar. I would like an Ohio bar is steroids. Like,
you know, what's that bull? Bull.
Yeah, the Bull
brand, the Japan brand.
Yeah, man.
That bar, I love deadlifting on that bar because I actually do notice a little bit of a difference in how much it gives.
Yeah, I think like the Tight X is the whippiest, then the Bull, then the Rogue Ohio, then the Aliko.
This is such a niche conversation. It's just like 99% of our audience are just like,
just
nope.
A degree, like a barely a degree of separation. Man.
But
I can't believe you're saying that the Titex is okay. That's like the worst lifting experience I've ever had was when I tried to make that work.
So whippy though.
I think one time I warmed up on a Titex bar. I don't think I've ever really used them.
But I'm a little bit picky with bars, more than plates and racks actually. Like a rack's a rack, a plate's a plate. But if I got a good bar, I can get my training done. If the bar
I agree with that.
Yeah, that would be my choice.
The bar is the biggest difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, I honestly don't care. The only thing that stresses me out is the commercial gym that I used to train in had like a refurb, and they used to have like 20 kilo bars that were like pretty terrible, but they were like kind of thick and had a center nelly, so like you could squat with them. Whereas now they've gotten in like the smooth middle like CrossFit style bars, and they're really thin. They're like 28 mil. So I've basically gone from like having like a real cool place to like train in to now I can't really do anything but deadlift there because like the bar is even so thin that when you go to bench with it, it's like kind of painful where it's like hasn't got the millimeters to like actually sit in your hand very well, and the bar just slides straight off your back.
I like 100%. I don't like the Rogue CrossFit bars. I'm sorry that we're still talking about bars, but like this just pisses me off. The Rogue CrossFit bars that don't have a sentinel. And I'm like, why can't
bars being complete princesses on the internet? This is so good.
Yeah.
Peach, do you also find pound plates addictive as well as bumper plates?
Oh yeah. Oh dude. Oh, there's this old Evanko 45 pound like deep dish plate set that I used to train on all the time, and they are just like the best. Honestly, they are just, they should run every competition with them. They're just, there's something so like, they're so steeped in like iron history. I just feel like they need to make a contract with Evanko and just have those deep dish plates, man. It would look so much cooler as well. Like, why'd you have to have calibrated plates? Like, seriously. Deadlifts would be bigger. It would look way cooler. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to worry about guys like Bryce who are like, oh, I can't fit all the plates in the bar. But other than that, you know, like, imagine how great it would look. You know?
I really like the warm-up jumps of going, like, with pound plates at a time. And I think I finally understand why Europeans go by 20 kilo jumps. And why when you go into like any European gym, there's just like 6 20 kilo plates on there. And I look at that and I'm like, what the hell? How do you, because we have two sets of 20s at our gym and like 25 sets of 25s. So it just like, it's not a thing. It doesn't happen. Nobody does that or can do that. But whenever I warm up on pound plates, I really like the sort of like more incremental or smaller increments of warming up that way. I also like that with the pound plates at our gym, you have no idea what weight is actually on the bar.
That's one thing that I used to kind of like play around with back when I trained on those pound plates, is there would be pound and kilo plates.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like do a training cycle with the kilo plates and then go over to the pound ones and like in my head kind of do the same thing. But actually I've kind of like microdosed my way up to being like 4 or 5 kilos heavier on every set, which obviously adds up. So that was always cool, like having that additional option, I guess.
Right. We are going to move on now. Cool question I thought was, if someone wants to program for themselves, how do they get to that point where they have like just a decent amount of knowledge where they can just lay down the program for themselves and make it work? The person who asked the question was specifically asking about what resources to go to, like YouTube channels and books and stuff. But I'm just going to say generally, what can you do to get yourself there?
I think it's just trial and error, right? Like, I think from like a perspective of it, if I knew, like when I started like generally training and like training myself, the only thing that I wish I was told was like, a bit like what Bryce said earlier, find a way to track what you're doing a little bit better, rather than this is the program, this is what I'm doing, did it work, did it not? It's a bit too big. It's like, it worked, but what worked? If I was told, oh, there's this cool app, or there's like, you know, something like My Strength Book or whatever, or any way, if you're good with spreadsheets, just learning how to track your metrics. If I got told that 3, 4, 5 years earlier, I think that would have spared up my understanding a little bit more. Because I think the best thing, you sort of know what works for you eventually. Like, the more you trial and error it, the more you know. And like, if someone says to me like, oh, I really like X, I'm going to put X in the program, because there's probably a reason why you like it. It's because either you're good at it, so your intent is there and you're really good at that movement and your intent is there with that movement, or deep down you know it helps you progress. And I suppose I think that's the one thing for me would be like, I wish I learned how to track and use data better.
Yeah, I think earlier. There's like, one of the things I would recommend if you want to program for yourself is go get a copy of like every free powerlifting program that's out there and just pour over those. Like, that's a great, like, if you can pick those apart and think critically about why certain people program certain ways, as well as if you have the time to like try out a bunch of those free programs, there's so many free resources. If you can try that stuff out and be like, okay, well, this block worked really well for my bench, and then this guy's program worked well for my deadlift, and then you can start to pick out what works for you and then investigate more into, you know, whoever made the program, go look at their YouTube or Instagram, or maybe send them a message, or, you know, reach out in some way, shape, or form. In terms of like more formal resources, the RTS classroom is something I always recommend. If you're interested in like auto regulation or how Mike and RTS do their stuff, I've learned a shitload from him and from that, from their sort of online classroom. The Helms books, like the Muscle and Strength Pyramid book, is a pretty fantastic resource. Greg Knuckles has a lot of really, really good stuff. I'm not sure how far he goes in on programming, but I mean, I would also look at, like, I don't know, if you can translate it to English, check out some of Louis Simmons's articles that he's written. if you can glean information from that, you know, check it out, try some of that stuff out. Don't be afraid to like pull from competing pools and different philosophies to try to put together your own philosophy on what works and doesn't. Don't be afraid to be influenced by all kinds of crazy shit. You know,
have you learned anything from Louis Simmons yourself?
Myself?
Yeah.
So here's something. I was having a conversation recently about the old like sort of conceptualization of West Side speed work, right? The like 40% whatever sets of three, you get 7 sets, whatever. Now there's this emerging research on velocity loss and how there may sort of be optimal zones where if you're doing a higher number of reps, you're using a very low RPE. And I would be surprised if those percentages didn't correlate somewhat with what a lot of the old West Side Speedwork stuff was doing. So, I mean, it's interesting to see that, maybe be vetted in some research or at least seeing some loose parallels. But, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where I think the overall sort of philosophy of, you know, if it can't make me better, I don't give a shit. You know, and if it can make me better, I don't care if it kills me. Like, that attitude just always kind of drove me away from a lot of that stuff. But I don't think it's useless, and I don't think that people should shy away from that just because they're drug free or just because they're a raw lifter. You know, try some of that stuff out. I tried a lot of it out when I was less experienced, and I think that maybe for that reason alone, just not knowing what I needed as a training stimulus, it didn't work. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's lots of nuggets of wisdom to be gleaned from all kinds of corners of the internet and corners of training philosophy.
I would absolutely agree with Bryce on that, for sure, man. And I think I think we were all probably kind of lucky that the time that we came up in the industry, there was a lot of like regular content posted in like article based forms, and like it was kind of like the emergence of some video content and stuff like that. So like when I kind of got started, it was much more around like principles of kind of strength and conditioning and that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. alongside like, I remember when I very first started working in the fitness industry, I worked on like a reception in like a health club. So I was basically like a towel boy. But the beautiful part of that was like, once like the first morning rush had kind of gone, I just sat there and read articles like every day. So like I was flicking through like T-Nation and like Elite FTS, and back in the day when like Poliquin had a website that he updated all the time. Mm-hmm. So like the foundational learning stuff was really, really cool. And then like, honestly, I learned a ton from just like program hopping. Like, oh, this sounds good, I'll do this. This sounds good, I'll do this, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing that, the lesson that I learned from doing that is kind of for anyone that's going to start programming, is understand what the like purpose of the training approach that you're taking is, and make sure that you're not trying to like do everything all at once. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to add 10 kilos of muscle mass and, you know, learn how to Olympic lift and add 15 kilos to your deadlift and whatever all in one training block. Like, work out the like the real adaptations that you're trying to make. I mean, actually, you probably would if you added 15 kilos of muscle mass, but you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, if you need to kind of work out what your approach is and what you're trying to do, and not try and ride like try and do 100 different things all in one training block, because that's kind of when you end up kind of going nowhere and you just end up like beating the shit out of yourself without doing anything.
All right, let's see what else we got here. Is Nando's overrated? Discuss. All right, listen, no. Mate. Listen, mate.
Is Nando's even rated? Like, do people rate Nando's pretty highly? Or
yes, they do. Yeah. I don't think Nando's is overrated, and I don't even eat chicken. Okay, suggesting that Nando's might be overrated is that is cultural terrorism.
I think, especially in the culture of this group of people right here.
If you think it's overrated, you're choosing the wrong things. That's my. You like bang for your buck. You need to make sure you're getting the right food choices. If you're just getting like a single pita and some macho peas, yeah, you're a mug. You know.
whoever sent this question in though, can you message it on us on Instagram and give us your address, because Bryce said he would fight you.
I didn't think that would make the cut. I've had Nando's a few times since I've been home, and it wasn't as good. And maybe it's just because you guys weren't there, but the menu is slightly different. And the like the double chicken pita with pineapple and halloumi that was my go-to when I was there.
It's the one.
It was just different. It wasn't quite available the same here. There was just something. And I've had takeout from there a few times, and it was really bad. I think just because it was busy and the takeout sat in a bag forever. But yeah, it depends on how you consume your Nando's and what you expect from it, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of our experiences have been quite romantic. Mm-hmm. So
maybe over romanticized, but find me another restaurant that's more cheeky to eat at.
Precisely. Owen, how do you maximize energy when you're on a massive cut that takes like years?
As in a calorie cut?
You know? Yeah, like wait, you know, you're just,
yeah, I suppose that
just going down. Going down. How do you just not run out of energy?
You do. But it's
simple as
it's
that.
Prioritizing. Like, I think once you get to a point where you're at a massive calorie deficit, or you're at a point where you're trying to those final couple of weeks of a cut where you can't expect to be feeling great all the time. Like, but I think prioritizing or having your priorities straight is super important. Like, if you're in that last little bit of a deficit and you've got a heavy squat session, you make sure you do everything you can to make that heavy squat session the best you can. If you're hungry for the rest of the day, tough shit. Like, I do.
That is such an Owen answer. Oh my God.
But it's sort of like, if that's your priority and your training is your priority, then that's what you got to do. And if you are hungry later in the day, you can have the things of having like a lot of high volume foods, trying to make the best out of it. But, you know, 800 calories in the next 12 hours of the day, you're always going to feel hungry no matter what. Like, but also if you're trying to look a little bit better, maybe feeling good for the whole day is better than having the perfect squat session. You know, like, it depends on really what your goal is. And I would say if you're in a massive cut and you're doing it for a powerlifting reason, maybe you want to reevaluate why you're doing it. And if that is a long-term thing, is that sustainable in the sport? If you're doing it to just be shredded on holiday, then crack on. But there's a difference, I think, in the reasons behind what you're doing and your approach. That would be my answer.
I've been bulking since 2012, so
Peach should know. Peach is on the shreds right now. Peach is like half the man he was 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, prioritizing food around training for output and performance is probably the biggest thing that I would say. And make sure you drink plenty of water.
Yeah, water helps. Or like teas. Like, teas, yeah. Yeah, green tea. Green tea is
English breakfast tea, mate. Underrated. Just plain black English breakfast tea.
I'll give you that.
It's decent. It's decent.
So, Bryce, you got sent a question of who was the best knee wrap you ever got?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I would kind of be interested to open that up to, like, guys, at competition, what's, like, the best handling experience you ever had? Or maybe the best handling, like, you ever, you know, borne witness to? You know, maybe that person wasn't handling you specifically, but you were there.
Do you want me to answer the knee wrap thing first?
Yeah, if one springs to mind.
There's a few. So I had had my buddy Eric Gunnum, who's a Swedish lifter. He does raw and equipped stuff, but him and his lovely crew of Swedes, and I think Oliver might have been there too, actually. But they wrapped my knees in Dubai, and that was fantastic. I had scabs on the back of my knees for like 3 weeks afterwards, because the Swedes have this technique where they like lay the wrap down and then pull it tight, and it results in a lot of like friction. So it beats you up pretty good, but they do a very, very tight wrap, or they did that day anyways. So that was good. And I also had a buddy of mine, Seth Albersworth, who competes multiply, or did at least. He squatted 1,000 when he was like 20 or 21. I remember him like chalking his hands, putting a mat down for his knees, and hitting ammonia before wrapping me. And this was pretty early in my equipped career, and I remember squatting like the fastest rep I had with that weight, and maybe still to this day, just because I wanted the wraps to be off so badly. Like, I wanted it to be done so badly that my squat rep was incredibly fast. So those are probably the two best wraps I've had.
I used to wrap my own knees, so I can't say anything about that with a wrap.
So. Okay.
Like,
so you could say your own was the best.
Yeah, I would say my wraps were the best. I don't know, from a handling, like, anyone who knows Aaron Singh is like, Aaron's the man for, like, I think from anyone ever who's done, like, handled me on a day, he's the guy where whatever he says goes on the bar. Like, I have absolutely, I'm quite passive in coaching on the day anyway. Like, I just do what's been told. But if it's a tight situation with numbers and Aaron says, you know, I need to pull 300, I know that is exactly the number I need to do. Or if I only have to do 285, I know I don't even need to look at the board. So he's definitely the guy who I think is the, from the GB side anyway, that I would trust the most out of like number selection. I really like, I don't know his name. I want to say Dylan something, but he helps Kimberly Walford out on the Virgin Isles team. He's got dreadlocks. Can't remember his name now, but every time I don't know his name, but every time I've seen him coach, he just seems like everyone has a great time. Like, and that's sometimes what it's about. And every time I see him, he's so enthusiastic, and I'd be like, yeah, I'd be on your side.
I think for me, shout outs go to our boy Oscar Bjork. I've seen him and the Swedish team do some real cool things and be really, really clever at certain times. As well, actually, I think the best single one that I've like ever witnessed would have been Mr. Jeff Butt and Maria T for that last pull with the wrist wrap and all that stuff, which I think we've mentioned the story before. But I think that was probably one of the most kind of like, I don't even know how to explain it really, you know, whether or not it's changing that variable that allowed Maria to do that, whether or not it was the actual wrist wrap itself, whether or not it was the actual coaching and the conversation that went on. But like to do that, that was Maria who did the lifting, but there was some serious tweaking going on in that back room to make that happen. So I think credit goes there.
I'm so happy to hear Jeff Butt get some hype on this podcast. Huge,
I was actually going to... That was going to be one of mine too, because Jeff Butt was the Team Canada coach at North Americans in 2015 when I broke the open IPF world record. And he was the one who had like, and I was a pretty naive lifter at this point. That's 3 years into my lifting career. But he had crunched the numbers on best lifter and was like, here's what you need. You're only going to pull 2.5 over the record or 0.5 over there. I think it was 0.5 over the record. He's like, that's all you need, because you need to make this, because you can take best lifter with it as well. And I was like, okay, whatever you say, Jeff. And went out and pulled it. And it was like an absolute limit lift. I just about dropped it. But I did end up winning best lifter that meet. And if he hadn't done those calculations and been in my ear about it, I would have had no idea that that was even like, I wouldn't have even considered that. And then the other one I would say is probably my nutrition coach, Mark Morris, who's handled me at a few meets. He's really good with the numbers. He's really good at, just like keeping things kind of not like light, but just like keeping a sort of conversational tone about things and not making things seem more dramatic or bigger than they are. And just there were a few things like that. And even as a coach myself, sometimes I've been at the screen crunching numbers and he's come by and I've like grabbed him and been like, Mark, like help me double check this math real quick because I need to put this number in. But yeah, he's really good with that kind of stuff. So Mark Morris and Jeff Butt, I'd say would be the two that I would say.
Just love Jeff. I don't know if this is interesting for anyone, but Jeff is the guy, he's the meet director who's given Wildlights Media the best experience in terms of covering a meet. And that was the first one we did outside Europe, but he just made sure we were absolutely taken care of. There was a lot of ways that could have gone wrong going to Canada to do that thing, but he's the guy who made sure that it was plain sailing. Love you, Jeff. Paige, Divas asks, who is the biggest flannel? Can you tell me what that means?
I'm not really sure what he means by this.
Okay, I thought you might be able to.
But I would imagine that in this particular conversation, Samuel, it's going to be me or you. And I'm not going to throw you under the bus like that. So I'm going to say I am the biggest flannel.
Is flannel a bad thing? Like, does it mean...
Yeah, like you're a wet flannel.
Being a blanket? Like a wet blanket kind of thing?
Yeah, kind of thing. Okay. Yeah. So, like, I can't really throw that at either of you two particularly well.
I was thinking, like, I'm rugged gonna, lumberjack type. When I hear flannel, I think, like...
Oh, like a flannel shirt?
Yeah. That's what you meant, right? Yeah.
Okay, if that's the case, I think that would probably be Bryce, because you most recently climbed a mountain, which would give you the lumberjack privilege.
That would make it you. Glad to hold on to that privilege.
So Bryce Korchek is the biggest flannel.
I'll take it.
The final question comes from Kieran Gray. Hey, aesthetic lifters, potentially a bit underrated. Kieran Gray, I love watching that guy lift. Most beautiful conventional deadlift potentially anywhere in the IPF, like just absolutely outstanding lifter. He asks, poutine, comma, yes or no, question mark.
Of course, why not?
Do you think everyone's going to know what poutine is, Samuel? Or Bryce? Like, Bryce. Are the UK audience going to know exactly what it is?
I feel like it's pretty poutine. Widely known. It's French fries with cheese curds and gravy. It's pretty delicious.
What's not to love, right?
And it's very stereotypically Canadian.
But we have that in the UK pretty much, up north, chips and gravy.
Pretty, yeah.
Like, it's a thing just without the curds. It's a good choice, though. Poutine is good. And poutine in the UK is terrible versus Canadian poutine. There is a big difference.
We actually have a restaurant downtown called The Poutinery. And I think they do things like butter chicken poutine and like all kinds of crazy stuff.
I've been there.
You've been there. You went when you were here?
Yeah. I went over there. Well, a friend who I went to see, they were like, you got to go to this place. It was the first place they took me to.
What did you have? Tell us all about it.
Yeah, please.
I think I just had normal poutine because I'd never had poutine before. Classic. So yeah. I was like the classic, you know.
Yeah, like, you're like, I'm here at the poutinery. It was like poutine.
What are we going to do in Canada? They were like, poutine, Tim Hortons, and Cora's. And they were like, this is
what
it.
What was the third one?
Cora's? Is it Cora's or Cora? It's like a breakfast place in somewhere.
Yeah.
But they give you...
You could have skipped Tim Hortons.
I quite like Tim Hortons, just not coffee. The coffee is terrible. The
coffee's not good.
It's not coffee.
Yeah.
But the Timbits are banging. Like,
yeah.
I'll give you that.
I know. So that same Seth guy I was talking about who squatted 1,000, he gained like... He's one of those guys that I think by like 17 or 18 was like, I'm going to be amazing at something. And he fell in love with powerlifting around that same time and was like, oh, to be a powerlifter, I have to be gargantuan. So he put on like 120 pounds in a year or something crazy like that. And he said he did it like 20 Timbits a day. That was one of his staples to gain that weight.
I think Timbits is a good thing coming around to the start of the podcast, like how to gain weight. Because Timbits are like, you don't even know you're eating them, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, you can put down like 10 or 20 of those pretty quickly.
Yeah. Timbit shakes.
Advice for gaining weight. Step one, go to Canada.
Or buy normal donuts, chop them into small bits.
Oh, controversial.
I don't know. That feels like pretty much the same thing to me.
All right. Well, now that we've given the best piece of advice ever, I think we're going to wrap this up. I
had to wait till the end for that one, deep cut.
Yeah.
It was good, man. It was good to have the gang back together.
Mm-hmm.
The Nandozers.
Pete, what's up, man?
Where can people follow you on social media and so on?
You can find me on Instagram at Peach Squats. You can find my coaching stuff at Battalion Barbell. And you can find the podcast at X188. Owen, where can they find you, man?
Yeah, just find me at OHub on Instagram. Where can they find you, Bryce?
Put your pens and papers up, kids. You can find me at Calgary Barbell most places, as well as my own personal Instagram, Bryce_CBB.
Mm. Man, I clicked so fast on that squat tutorial you guys published on YouTube.
Oh yeah, you like
a few
that?
Days
huh?
ago.
Oh, sweet. Check that out.
There it is. Yeah,
been working on that one for a while.
Bang bang.